Welcome to Cloudlandia. Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Jackson.
Well, daylight savings can't trick us.
No, we have a foot in each world, you know. A couple times a year, we're, you know, the mainland world does a shift. And I always, I don't know about you, but spring always depresses me. And the shift in the autumn actually always energizes me, because I feel something's been taken away from me.
I was going to say the same thing. Do you know what I often do is I often don't exercise my extra hour in the fall right away. And sometimes I'll save it. And I'll say, today I'm going to use my extra hour.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's no choice. They just take the hour right away from
They just take the hour. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I truly believe that you and I live in a self-generated world. I won't say it's a democratic world, but it's a self-generated world. Mm-hmm. And anytime, you know, a conversation comes up in, let's say, Strategic Coach Workshop, you know, about how we're being deprived of our liberty. And I said, okay, well, let's just check this out. First of all, give me the facts that tell you that other people are taking away your freedom. Okay, mm-hmm. They do. And I said, well, yeah, I can see how you can see that. Yep, yep. And I said, but let me ask you a question. If we plan your next quarter, and you have four goals. One is to increase your freedom of time.
Yes.
Secondly, your freedom of money. Thirdly, your freedom of relationship. And fourth, freedom of purpose. Can you do that regardless of what's happening in the world?
Mm-hmm.
And they all say yes. And I said, well, one of them's true. They're taking your freedom away, or you can grant yourself new freedom. I said, one of them's true. You know, it depends on which one you choose.
That's it. Yeah, that's something, and it's so great to know, you know, we're completely playing a different game. It's like I've been speaking at some different events over the last couple of weeks here by Zoom, and one of the things that I've been sharing that comes up is the VCR formula and the. You know, it's met universally with clarity that people are like, oh, wow. Like now they see, it's like giving somebody 3D glasses. Yes. When you can now see how things are you know, organized, you can see where your place in that game is, you know, and it's okay that you don't have to be all of these things.
Yeah. Very interesting from a historical standpoint. I use the Gutenberg Revolution a lot for early science. And there's just a lot of things that happen differently as a result of movable type, having printing presses with movable type. But a couple of them were really, really interesting that haven't been really talked about that much. And one of them is that people started reading alone because before that, books were rare, books were very expensive, and only certain people were actually literate, you know, they were usually church members, and there were lawyers and, the members of the church, they would have been monks or priests or anything else. And they were literate. And generally speaking, the printed word was used in public, where someone who knew how to read would read the words for everyone else, and they'd sit and listen to it.
I wondered about that. So books were read aloud, like as an event.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, there were scholars. I'm not saying there weren't people who were scholars, but they were a very, very, very small portion of the population, and it wasn't a general thing. But what happened with books, and, you know, I don't know how many years or decades it was, but it became widespread that people would have personal libraries, and these were, you know, they'd have to have wealth because they'd have to pay, the books were very expensive, but they'd collect books, and then they would have a library, and they would go in and in the evening. Well, usually it would be during the day because lighting was very, very expensive,
right? You know,
evening lighting, and they'd read, and then there were sort of pamphlets, which were a big sheet, which was folded into 16 pages. You would fold it once, you'd fold it twice, and that gave you 8, and then you'd fold it one more time, and you had 16 pages, and they'd print it as a pamphlet. And, you know, and then people would be in copy houses, they'd be in bars, and they would read these pamphlets, and then they'd discuss them. And I think that's going on right now. I think what you and I are experiencing right now with Zoom, especially, is very, very similar to a way of bringing up ideas and talking about them that, to a certain extent, is beyond the knowledge and beyond the control of whoever thinks they're in charge.
Mm. Wasn't that something? What was the, you mentioned pamphlets. Wasn't it the Reynolds pamphlets, or were they called Reynolds pamphlets or Reynolds papers? What were they called?
Well, the big thing was they didn't bind them. They just they sort of folded up like a map. Okay.
Right.
But what they would do with that, each of the, you know, when you have a map, there's you know, rectangles that are created by the fold.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what they would do is they would print each of those folds as a separate page. But
right.
then it could be folded up, and because binding was very expensive, and you know,
right.
And so you would just fold it up, and this is the way that you know, regulations were printed up and sent out. This was financial rules, and currency exchange rates. A lot of it was commercial. A lot of it was commercial. It was just that there were understand rules for trading. There was a huge trading network across Northern Europe, all the way from England to Russia.
Yeah.
And it was called the Hanseatic League. And it had about, in total, over a period of about 300 or 400 years, it probably had 3 dozen cities. And some would, you know, blink out, and new ones would come along and everything like that. But what they did is they created standard policies for currency exchange, for letters of credit, for rules, you know, contract rules. And their main way after Gutenberg of actually letting everybody know what the rules were these folded up pamphlets.
Mm.
Yeah. But the change that I see, and I want to go back to your VCR, is that in the mainland, it was all about what you were going to do, you know, like over the course of a lifetime. And, you know, you're going to learn your reading, writing, and arithmetic, and, you know, and you're going to be a good student, and you're going to pass tests, and you're going to get into university, and you're going to go through undergraduate university, and you're going to specialize in something that will get you a good job, and then you will be in that job, and you'll move up the ranks. And
right.
It was all about you, but it was all about you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was really irrespective of who the other people were that you were doing this with. And I think with Zoom and, you know, all internet things that have developed over the last quarter century, I believe that to have just to focus on yourself, you're missing out on 99% of the action.
And what you've done, right?
Yeah, what you've done is you've simply said, don't think about the vision of what you as an individual, a lone individual, can achieve. Think about what could be achieved, period, regardless of who did it. Mm-hmm. And you put down your visions, and then you say, well, what are all the capabilities that I have? Well, I have mine, but I can also put down technology. I can also put down networks. I know other people's capabilities. And the internet. The internet is a huge capability. Zoom's a huge capability. Mobile phones are a huge capability. And then how much reach can I have? If I add my vision plus the capabilities, what can multiply all that out in the world? And my sense is that you can, from my perspective, I'm just looking at my own personal experience for the last year, which is yesterday, by the way, that was our last. March 13th. I said, well, first of all, my own ability has jumped enormously, but so has our company. So has our, you know, program. And so have all the entrepreneurs in the program, those who have been positive and, you know, and enthusiastic about acquiring Zoom as a new capability. This is a real shift. And the VCR is a much more sensible way of looking at your future than how you might have looked at it just as a single individual.
I agree. Yeah. Especially it fits so perfectly with the free zone frontier. Mm-hmm. It feels exactly like the underpinning of that in a way, you know, that there's something they fit hand in hand. And, you know, you look at now this week, I think we should, we're documenting, you know, what's happening with, I think we've mentioned NFTs, last week, non-fungible tokens. Well, this week, you know, Beeple, a digital artist, sold a digital artwork for $69 million.
Yep. Jack Dorsey put the very first tweet up online and is having an auction, and so far the highest bid that I saw most recently was $2.5 million for the first tweet.
Right. And now, Rob Gronkowski just had an auction that completed last night on some of his greatest Super Bowl moments. That are all, you know, numbered and limited editions of them. But then there's a one of one that is, I forget what they call it, a refractor card. I don't know what that means yet, but it comes with a physical representation of it, I guess, signed by him. And that was auctioned off as well. And I went over and looked at what the NBA is doing, and the NBA is selling digital moments of things like LaMelo Ball's first, triple double game highlight from
LeBron's greatest dunk.
Yes, exactly. And I'm thinking, man.
William Shatner's teeth X-rays.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Yeah, he took verified X-rays of his teeth, and he created cards, limited edition number of cards, and he's putting them out on the internet. And they're being purchased.
This is just—it's crazy, but that's now, we're seeing. And I read a really thoughtful article. Now, I think it was in the New York Times. It was either the New York Times or CNBC, one of those, that was talking about it as it's not even, it doesn't matter what is happening right now, that it's art or that it's, it doesn't make sense what's going on. What it's ushering in is this, you know, the structure around it of having digital ownership of something.
Well, can I tell you something? Mm-hmm. You were into this 20, 25 years ago. It's just uh-huh. that it didn't have a name for it. And mm-hmm. your analysis of a real estate market and breaking it down into
right.
And then you created a one-off for each real estate neighborhood. Okay,
yeah.
And you could purchase that. And as long as you purchased it, it was yours. No one else could have this knowledge. Okay, mm-hmm. so that's an NF. First of all, it was digital. You had already
said yeah.
it was digital. They were buying a digital, non-fungible token. Okay, mm-hmm. so you had already done this. You know, you had already done this. So,
I thought about that with Stop Your Divorce, too. When I first did that digital ebook, it was really, I was to explain it to people that I'm basically selling it's not actually like selling a book. It's like selling a picture of a book that, yeah. you know, it doesn't take away. I can print as many of them as you need. There's zero cost yeah. to distribute it. And we've sold, you know, a lot of them.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. You know, I've gone deep for a specific reason. I've gone very, very deep in understanding intellectual property law. You know, and there's about six major categories of intellectual property protections. One is a patent. Patent, you have trademarks, you have copyrights. Then you have things like trade design, and you have, there's even a thing called trade secrets.
Yeah.
And so this is property, already, you know, I mean, this had already entered into the digital world a long time ago. And an example is a Supreme Court case that's been 10 years in the making. And Oracle, with a very, very good foundation, can prove that the first 10,000 lines of code, which actually created Google's search engine, was stolen from Oracle.
And I remember you mentioned that.
Yeah, and they actually have a letter from Google to Oracle that says, can we license the first 10,000 lines? Oracle said no, and then Google went ahead and did it anyway. Okay, so the interesting thing is what the court case, I think it'll probably come due this June, you know, it's probably in this session. And the way these things are settled, you know, if, let's say the court rules in Oracle's favor, the way this is settled is that there's a penalty that the loser has to pay. And that is because of these, what portion of your revenues since the moment you started using it is owing to Oracle, because you've been mm-hmm. improperly living off of someone else's property and uh-huh. you haven't been paying them for the property. Well, that those 10,000 lines of, you know, of coding mm-hmm. are non-fungible. Google was saying, no, they're fungible, and Oracle was saying, no, they're non-fungible. And the Supreme Court will decide whose case is right there.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's very, very interesting. I think it's just property law moving into the into Cloudlandia.
Yeah, and I wonder how this, it's going to be an interesting thing to see how this plays out. Like, because what I think they were talking about in the article is this idea of smart contracts, that now you can, like, at the source.
Well, it only exists because of blockchain technology.
Right.
Okay. You couldn't even have these discussions. You couldn't even have these examples if you didn't have a new technology called blockchain, which means that the record of, let's say, your real estate formulas for each of the neighborhoods, this can be entered into a record with millions of other records. And to change your record, you'd have to change the other million records. So in the digital world, you know, there are countries like Nigeria and Russia that literally have been making a gross national product for the last 20 years of just stealing other people's, fooling around with other people's information and stealing other people's information. And there's been no recourse to that. And now there,
How would it enforce, like, so let's say, so here's one of the things that I think of, that one of the, you can help me think through these, the algorithms here. So let's say that, because a lot of the things that I have are things where you've heard me talk about the scale-ready algorithm, where I have a lot over all of this history of my career here. I've got a lot of things that are what I call syndications, where I figure out, I was just looking at one the other day, I've got an ad for reverse mortgages, two different ones that are, you know, that have run in many different magazines and been used as postcards. So I look at that. If I create something like that as an NFT, or thinking out loud here, the way that I've been kind of licensing those things to people, and what I'm kind of thinking about it going forward is there a way to use that to get a royalty? Or it seems like it's difficult to track things like that. Like, how would that help, aid in a situation?
First of all, I'll start with the consumer point of view on this, rather than the innovator or the inventor. Okay, so I'll start with the consumer. People are paying lots of money for things which are essentially fraudulent or fake. Okay. You know, and I mean, all my lifetime, probably my adult lifetime, I've heard about fake pain, forgery, payment.
Yes.
Forgery, currency itself. You have, fake currency. And then, very, very expensive, like jewelry, like Rolexes and everything. And it's been an incredible problem. Diamonds, there's all sorts of things. So from a consumer standpoint, I think it'll be an app, on your cell phone. And if you're offered something, you'll say, let me check this on the
the digital certificate,
and
right.
The NFT, it's an NFT app. And I put it and say, I'm sorry, this is not listed on blockchain. This is not a real thing. So what it's going to require is that if you create something, then you have to list it and you have to get it has to be digitized and you have to get, some sort of signal that tells you, yes, this has been digitized. And that's what the consumer will pick up when it would be about anything. It would be about, William Shatner's dental x-rays or Ron James junk or not his junk. His junk.
No.
Now that might
that'd be a separate of what do they call it?
That'd be
an NSW, an NSW NFT. Not suitable for work NFT.
Yeah. Well, I've just introduced a whole new, you know, category.
Oh, that's right. Quick, and, let's create an NFT of this moment right here. The genesis of the NSW NFT.
Yeah, so the whole thing is that the central rule of the marketplace is that things are only worth as much as someone wants to pay for them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, so when people say, well, this is really silly, a digital painting for $69 million, this is really silly. I said, well, what's silly about it? You know, what's silly about it?
Yeah.
I said, nothing silly about it. I said, somebody out there thinks that this is worth $69 million and they just paid for it. That proves to me that the value of this is $69 million. And people say, but it's absurd. It's absurd. There's school teachers, you know. I said, yeah, but put a school teacher out there and see how much people will pay for the school teacher.
You know? Right, exactly.
I'll put the painting here and the school teacher here. Would you?
Yeah.
Well, which would you pay more for? You know.
Yeah.
Well, this is immoral. You know. I mean, the path. Nope. That's not how the marketplace works. The marketplace.
Right.
Things have value according to what people will pay for them.
Right.
And that's the central thing here. So people say, well, people will be putting everything out there and selling it. And I says, no. A lot of it will just be worthless because.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be no buyer out there that wants to pay for, you know, wants to pay for your latest Kleenex.
Right. Yeah, this is, wow.
So it's really taking the pricing mechanism of the marketplace, like yours, it's going right to, we're almost approaching the point where you have a thought, you do something, and then you register your expressed or articulated thought, like Jack Dorsey with the first tweet, you know, he puts it out there. Now, I know for a fact somebody will buy that tweet for $2.5 million, you know.
Yeah.
And it'll be part of their estate, you know, that they have this and they have the NFT proof that this is actually real. Yeah.
So how has this changed? Have you given any thought to? Tell me how you're thinking about it then.
Well,
for you.
Everything we've done, you know, everything we've created in Strategic Coach, because your company and my company are intellectual property companies. In other words, the Breakthrough Blueprint, the 8 profit activators. That's intellectual property. So what I'm saying is that I'm going to investigate with John Farrell, who's my go-to IP lawyer in Silicon Valley, and I'll say, John, how are you approaching this right now? You know, what's the latest thinking? What's the protection of that? And, you know, I'll actually do an interview with him, and I'll just get a recording of the interview, and then, you know, I'll just send it out to all the Strategic Coach clients, you first, you know, and then I'll get that interview registered as an NFT.
Oh, see, right.
Well, or John could,
yeah.
Whatever, you know. But I think that if you want to say this really simplifies intellectual property protection, you know, you know, I don't understand the difference, you know, trademarks, patents, and everything else. It's an NFT.
Yeah, and it's first in. If you're first in, that's time stamped and dated and locked in concrete. digital concrete.
You got to be quick. You know, there'll be a whole new branch of law that develops out of this, you know, who was first, you know, who was actually first. But that happens with patents, that happens with trademarks and copyrights. That's already a game that's well established.
Right.
So my sense is that everything you ever knew about protecting something in the mainland all that is now, the complete logic of that, the complete attitude towards that is now just shifting completely to the Cloudlandia.
Yes. Wow. So this is a big, like, infrastructure moment. I mean, that's like a, that's what we're establishing all the, well, the laws
well,
here.
Well, mm-hmm. let's take Old Town Road. We've talked yeah. a lot about the teenager in Atlanta. Let's talk about the one in Copenhagen or Amsterdam.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Every mm-hmm. time he does a beat, he should get a NFT registration for every one of his beats.
Well, I think that the music industry of anything is pretty well, I think they're probably furthest ahead on the mm-hmm. digital front because they were honestly the first ones affected by it.
Yeah.
Right. When back in 1998, when, MP3s came out, that was now all of a sudden it freed the physical requirement of having a CD or a vinyl record of something.
What?
You know, now I think you can have a digital.
Yeah. I think it actually happened when the recording industry actually switched over from, imprinting plastic, you know, a thing, and it, switch over to magnetic recording. I think that the starting point for that was magnetic recording.
Yeah, that's interesting. When, because I think I remember reading
that's
about
in
that.
That was in the 20s. That's actually, that's actually very early. I mean, we're talking about the 30s or 40s.
I think it was even earlier. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was because I remember when I first started looking at the how we got to this point with text and pictures and video and sound that in 1922 there were some number of record labels, and Edison was actually one of the top labels, and there were the big four or whatever at that time, and the others switched to this magnetic, what you were describing, and Edison chose not to, And by the end of the decade, they were out of business, and the magnetic thing was the big winner.
Yeah, Edison at a certain point in his life went totally reactive and non-creative, and same thing happened in the movie industry. The original body that controlled movie making in the United States was called the Edison Trust, and they put rules down, and what they did is they put a set of rules that were completely vertically integrated. In other words, that the machine you used was part of the trust, the film you used was part of the trust, the product itself, how long it could be, that was part of the trust, and who could exhibit it was part of the trust. And it was a guy named Adolf Zukor who rebelled against this, and it was all controlled out of New York City. The entire movie industry in the United States was controlled out of New York City, and he went west, and he went to a place that was called Hollywood. It was a wood that had a lot of holly trees on it, and he went to Hollywood, and part of the reason he went there is that if the law came down on him because he was doing a lot of illegal stuff against the Edison Trust, that he wasn't far from Mexico. He could get across the Mexican border really fast.
Wow. So
they went to Los Angeles.
That's something. I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a great... when you really... I saw a thing about the... history of Hollywood, and you realize, man, that's been just 100 years, basically,
Yep. Yeah.
And you look at it now, I mean, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And then they became very oppressive. You know, they had the five studios that were five companies, and they price fixed, they, you know, restricted distribution and everything. It was a monopoly. I mean, it was five companies. But they all had breakfast with each other every day to determine, you know, how they were going to keep their control on that day. And this tendency towards, you get this wild, you know, like NFT right now, this is going to be a wild entrepreneurial realm. Mm-hmm. And then there will become expert corporations in this, you know, and the blockchain world, you know, there will be a consolidation of the blockchain companies, the companies that are the key blockchain companies, and then they'll have a relationship with national governments, you know, to enforce laws and everything like that. Facebook and, you know, Google and Twitter and everything like that. These are pretty small players, considering some of the monopolies. AT&T was immensely bigger than Facebook or Google can even think about getting.
I just look at this, how quickly things go. Like, I'm thinking about now, it's kind of NFT really just kind of showed up on our radar the last few weeks. It's really become kind of
I was
hot,
talking, we, you know? It was funny, on Wednesday, I did a podcast with Gord Vickman, who's my podcast manager. Uh-huh. We talked about NFT. And then 2 hours later, I did a podcast with Peter Diamandis. And, you know, Peter's been, you know, talking and investigating fakes, like fake photographs, fake avatars, fake, you know,
deep fake
audio
stuff. Yeah, right.
Fake stuff, you know, fake Tom Cruise, you know, all this stuff. And I said, well, I think that the NFT is a counter movement.
Yes, that's it.
How do we know it's a fake? Well, let's have a registry. And the other thing is vote fraud. You know, and already there's articles that I've read that every ballot will be an NFT. And when it's your ballot, your identification is tied to this. And this is lodged in as an NFT. So there can be no fake ballots in future elections, you know.
Wow.
So it's very, very interesting that a party that's very much for advanced technology is suddenly saying, but who have a history of being successful with fraudulent voting, they'll say, wait a minute. No, we don't extend this new technology to that. So it'll be a very contentious political issue about voting, you know, like every ballot's a one-off, and, you know, you just can't have high school students after election hours filling in ballots for one person. You can't do that anymore.
I wonder where this, like, if I look at right now, as an analog, let's look at Ghost Kitchens, which started mm-hmm. out, you know, let's call it 5 years now, that that now there's a whole category and an industry leader in virtual dining concepts as a thing, which is really the VCR, driven by the VCR formula. So now I wonder if we're just the word NFT is becoming a buzzword, mm-hmm. and so everybody's like flocking to it, making so anything can be an NFT. I think we've seen. So now I wonder if we fast forward, how does the industry kind of evolve around this? Where does this go?
I mean, you have to look here. which are most immediately accessible to do something with this? I think like diamonds, that was done long ago. Every diamond now that's sold at a reputable dealer now is already an NFT. It's got a digital imprint on the diamond that tells the complete history, where it was mined.
Oh, really?
Yes. Under what conditions?
Provenance, right.
Provenance, yeah. So so that's already established, you know, and I think paintings are probably going that, you know, anything that's a one-off artistic production, probably that's already well along the way. I'm just not someone who buys diamonds, so I wouldn't necessarily know about it firsthand, you know. I mean, you could say real estate, you know.
Yeah, certainly the blockchain.
Probably the first.
That's what I meant
about
the...
Well, even before, I mean, real estate law is very, you know, it's very robust. One of our clients here in Toronto, Sasha Kersmer, and you probably know Sasha.
I do.
And Sasha is the number one site surveyor in Canada, but he's certainly the big person here in Toronto. Mm-hmm. And he has actually achieved the sole license for all the real estate boundaries in the province of Ontario. He's got a perpetual license from a firm that actually does the it's done by satellite now, He is the monopolist who actually has the sole license. So if you're checking out real estate boundary lines, you're using a service that he's created, you know.
Wow.
So, you know, that knowledge could be an NFT, you know. Because every boundary line is, it can be that, and we've just gone through a purchase up north, and we're just doing a add-on to our cottage, and it had to be surveyed, and then it had to be submitted to the local, the local council that we were the right distance. The new thing was the right distance away from the shoreline.
Okay.
There's rules. And then we bought a new property next to it, and the original boundary lines were like 40 years old.
Uh-huh.
So it was resurveyed, a survey came through, and it was a foot off here, and it was 3 feet off here and there. So a new boundary line has been established, establishing exactly what the property is, you know. So anything that is a one-off that you want to prove the originality of it and the legitimacy of it as an NFT.
Right.
I was watching on YouTube last night the determination of whether Hitler actually died in the way that it was said. And it came down to his teeth, and they had records, dental records, going back 20, 30 years, and both the Russians and the Americans and the British and everything else determined that the set of teeth that were found in this skull, in the body, in the, you know, outside of the bunker, was his. This was his, you know. So, yeah. So, but it's now determined. Now here's the thing. Hitler's teeth could be an NFT. I mean, if you took Hitler's teeth and you actually put them on the, you know, on the internet and say, buy Hitler's teeth, I wonder how much they'd go for.
I wonder. Oh, man. This is such a, it's amazing to be at the beginning of of something.
Mm-hmm.
It really is.
The whole world is determined between the relationship of real and fake, and between a one-off and copies, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Part of our economy is based on one-offs, and part of our economy is based on copies.
Yeah.
If I take F.A. Hayek, you know, the economist who I think has done the best job of thinking through what capitalism actually is, he says that capitalism is an ever-expanding system. So what's the ever-expanding system here? The internet. It's mm-hmm. Cloudlandia. Cloudlandia is an ever-expanding yes. system of yep. increasing cooperation among strangers.
Yeah.
Okay. So what's the central issue of cooperation?
Yeah. Trust.
Trust. How do we know this is real?
Yes.
And so since the whole world has gone to an internet economy, faking has run ahead of real, so my sense is the law has to catch up with us so that if you're doing a deal with someone from, 12 time zones away, how do you trust without ever meeting the person? How do you?
Right.
So there has to be some way of barricading that this is real.
Yeah.
And it can't be changed. It can't be faked. It can't be copied. It can't be counterfeited.
Right. And that's, I think what's happening too, is that people could collaborate on something within a smart contract have
yeah.
the
yeah.
royalty of something or your fraction of something directed,
yeah.
Yeah. attributed to you. So
yeah.
that's the thing about the collaboration, that especially as everything, I think that's really, that's what I'm starting
well,
to understand.
Well, I think that this kind of in history kind of marks the point at which, just to use an example, that Facebook's power now declines. And the reason is because already national governments are saying, look, we're not going to allow you in here unless you pay to the media of this country your use of their property on Facebook. That happened in Australia 3 weeks ago. And now Canada is talking about it. Now the European Union is talking about it. And because the means are now available that you use anything digitally of somebody else's, there's a record yeah. of it.
Right. Yeah. And that's awesome. That's kind of a great opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, he had a free ride, it was like free
yeah.
property. It was like free land he had like a wide open range for like 20 years. And he just made a ton off of it. But now, the civilization is moving in after him and saying, we got to have some rules here.
Yeah. And now, yeah, boy, that's all. I think it's going to be amazing to watch this unfold in the next 5 years.
What's your sense? You and I are talking about it, and I've read about
yeah.
10 articles on it, and I've done 2 podcasts on it. And
yeah.
I'm probably more knowledgeable about mainland property law than a
yeah.
lot of people, simply because, of issues that we've had to deal with for 30 years, actually, for 30
yeah.
years. And so what's your sense of just having conversations with other people of where their understanding of what this is all about is?
I think there's certain people who understand more about it. Like, Evan Pagan is someone who knows more. He's pretty
yeah.
deep into
yeah.
it, very thoughtful, like looking for, his book was called Opportunity. So he's an opportunity seeker, as am I,
yeah.
and you. So he's on the cutting edge. But then there are other people who I don't even know what. I've been talking to Joe Polish about it, but you look at, let's just put this in context of the last. Joe's been on sabbatical since January, And so he doesn't really have any experience or knowledge of what Clubhouse is happening or what NFTs are. I think he's, although I think he is staying on top of that. But if you were, you know, someone who's just kind of stepped out for a bit, you've missed some big things as they've happened. I don't think people understand it, you know, or get a sense of what it is and how fundamentally it's changing. Where I'm looking towards the, because as I look more and more towards a future where I'm only contributing scale ready algorithms to collaboration. Yeah. That's what I'm geared. That's where my surfboard is pointed to that horizon now, on top of looking for the right waves to surf on that. But if that is a thing, that's what my primary interest in it is, to be able to contribute that portion of it and then turn it over to or collaborate with multipliers who can then take that to the world. And my contribution is valued and compensated for that portion of it without having to, you know, set up big enforcement structures and create anything around that.
No, I understand that. Well, first of all, you know, when we talk about intellectual property, you know, people say intellectual property, what's that like ideas? I said, before we start talking about this, I want you to look at the second word.
Property, yeah.
I said, you can forget the first word. The second word is what it's about. It's about property. And there's been a lot of foolishness. There's been a lot of foolishness in the magical thinking world. I mean, there's Cloudlandia, which is real, and then there's magical thinking, which is Cloudlandia that's not real. Okay, yeah. Magical thinking is, well, in the future, we won't own anything. And I said, who's the who aren't going to own anything? Because I'd like to know who the who's are who own what you don't own. You know, it's kind of like, you know, it's like universal basic income, you know, the whole notion that we're all going to be paid by the government, you know,
everybody's
going to get that. And I said, I'll tell you how this will work out. You have 100 people, okay, and at the first of the month, they all get $10,000. Okay, so it's $1 million. Okay, so it's $1 million that's worth. So on the first of the month, you have 100 people each have $10,000. I'll tell you how. I'll tell you what it looks like on the last day of the month. 20% of them have 80% of the money.
Mm-hmm. I bet you're right.
Yeah, it's Pareto's law. It's Pareto's law. First of all, because most of the people don't even know that from the government that $10,000 is property, but the others do. The 20% know it's property. The 80% don't know it's property. Yeah, it's sort of like that. There are certain people who know that things are worth something. And they've got lawyers and accountants, and they staff up and everything like that. So, and you know, I think that the least likely people to profit by this NFT thing is probably the millennial generation who've never owned anything. You know, like they're late into the ownership world because they got hit really hard in the 2008-2009. I think that the millennials will probably do in their lives what almost every previous other generation do, but they'll be 10 years behind. They'll get married 10 years behind. They'll buy real estate 10 years behind. They'll have children 10 years behind, which means they're not going to have many children. And the reason is because they got interrupted by economics in their development, and they had to be renters. You know, everything had to be on credit and renting. They never created any capital to actually have ownership. So the people who will be probably not clued in are probably people up till about 40 years old right now. People over 40 will really get this. The people under 40 won't get it. I mean, there'll be exceptions like, Mr. Beast will totally get this. You know, Lil Nas will totally get this. But they'll be the exception. They'll be the exceptions. But the vast majority of young people won't get this at all until much later.
Yeah, because, you know, but that's a perfect example when you look at this new Gen Z. They've never known anything. They've been born into this the digital world, digital natives. That's the thing.
It's really interesting. My generation started in 1928 and ended in 1946. So it's an 18-year by far, on a per capita basis, my generation is the wealthiest generation that the world has ever known. Okay.
What years were that?
1928 to 1946.
So you're the silent generation.
We're a silent, we're a quiet generation.
My mom was in that,
silent generation. And the reason is that we didn't go through the First World War. And we were children during the Depression, so we weren't out in the marketplace. And we didn't go through the Second World War. So, and then right after the war, there was this huge boom of economic activity. We just went up the express elevator where everybody else had to go floor by floor, you know. There was always opportunity. There were more jobs than there were us. There was more education available than there were us. So,
and you were right off the cusp. New schools, new everything.
And I know it affects my attitude about, the future and everything. We've been having sort of reviews of the last year, and people said, everybody was scared and you were really brave. I said, I was brave. I said, I just saw nothing but opportunity when the lockdown happened.
Yeah.
Because my whole life has just been about opportunity, and I see NFT and I said, oh, this is great. You know, this is great. I'm going to find out all about this real fast, because I've got a lot of stuff that is created. And so have all my clients. So I want to get on top of this right away and figure out how all my clients can take their original stuff and get it, get it on blockchain. You know, I mean, I said, this is huge. This is huge.
Yeah. Boy, oh boy.
Like you, Dean. Can I tell you something? Starting in 1985, so Babs and I met in 1982, Babs has saved every single sheet of paper that I've either done a drawing on or wrote an idea down. We've got 10,000 sheets of paper stored and filed and everything. Yes. And Bab says, you see any paper that Dan draws on, you save it and it goes in the file.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
I was just looking at,
I bet you have a lot of that stuff like that.
Well, just sitting right beside me here, I have a stack of some journals that I was looking through. And this one that I have in my hand here is from August to November of 1996. So this is, I would use these. When I first started using them, it was the account books, like ledger books, the Blue Line A796 record book with archival quality paper and all that. Because I knew even then it's something it was funny to want to,
This is like an original Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John scripture.
Oh boy.
This is like a first folio Shakespeare. I'm just saying that first of all, the marketplace determines whether anything is worth anything. But you never know, you know, somebody does a digital painting and it's worth $69 million, you know.
Yes. Well, what he sold was an amalgam of his everyday. He does digital artwork every day. And what he sold was an amalgam of the first 5,000 days. So it was one image of, you know, a representation of almost pixelated kind of thing of all 5,000 of the images.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a lot of work. I mean, that's 5,000 days work. I mean, very few painters have put in 5,000 painters to create, put in 5,000 days to create a painting, you know? So, yeah. I mean, first of all, I think that's worth something. I'm willing to bid on that. You know, this is the I think one of my, as I develop my quarterly books, there's an idea that the most disruptive force in the world is an unpredictable consumer with a new capability.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where all value is created.
Yeah.
Somebody who's an unpredictable consumer, and this person just got a new capability, and all of a sudden his vision has changed, his capability has changed, his sense of capability and his reach just changed. And I have to tell you, big data can't keep track of that.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this, oh, Dan, it's never ending.
I remember Ronald Reagan, it was probably around 1986 or so. And the big thing came up that the Russians were stealing U.S. secrets. And there was all this thing about the USSR stealing secrets. And he says, we ought to get every 747 airplane in the world, especially the cargo planes. And we ought to search the United States from one end to the other for every secret. And we ought to load them on, all the 747s. And we ought to fly them to Moscow and dump them on the runway. And he said, just trying to come to grips with what we've dropped on the runway will destroy the Soviet Union.
Wow.
And it was gone in 5 years, and maybe he had some insight on it. You know, I think same thing with the Chinese. They're surveilling everybody. You know, they've got massive numbers of millions of people who sit in front of computers and watch other people. And I said at a certain point, it's just one day too far that they've done this, and the entire system sort of freezes up and everything collapses.
Oh man.
Because there's no creativity in it. There's no creativity.
Right.
In it.
Yeah.
And,
boy.
And pay, just take care of yourself and, have big visions and,
use
your
down.
Capabilities correctly and collaborate with other people. And, you don't have to worry about what the rest of the world is doing.
Right. That's what I'm looking forward to is this.
So Dean, I'm asking your permission right here. I've got a free zone full day workshop coming up on Thursday. And I would like to take a first crack at what the form will look like for all the free zone entrepreneurs identifying themselves in terms of their PCR.
Oh, yes. I would love that.
Would you like that?
Yeah, I would love that.
Okay.
So there's a, I didn't realize.
And at the bottom, I have to tell you, at the bottom of the sheet, it says copyright and trademark Dean Jackson. So I just want to let you know.
I appreciate that. This is great.
No.
Yeah.
It's your total your thing, but I'll help develop the thinking on it. And all my thinking is your thinking. So all the thinking I do on this belongs to you. So I just want to let you know that.
This is great. So I got that going for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that.
So no matter what I do with it and how far I develop it, it's 100% yours.
I like that. So this is this Thursday?
This Thursday, yeah, in Chicago, yeah. Well, it's if it was in person, it would be a Chicago workshop, yeah. So I'm going to do it. And I put together some interesting tools, including this new, certainty, uncertainty, which is really a fascinating concept, new concept. And
Okay. No, it just dawned on me now that why I was thinking about that, but you've got two free zone groups. That's what it is.
So I have the first one. I have a first one and then another one in April, Yeah.
Right.
I may come
to this one if that's.
Yeah. But it starts at 10 Eastern time. So we move, we do it on Chicago based. So it's 10 to 4. I don't know exactly the timing yet, but it's going to be a great workshop. And everything. So the reason I wanted to have this recorded is that I want to establish that you and I, this is being recorded, that I'm establishing my basis for collaborations that, what I really want is a new capability but in the final analysis, the capability is 100% owned by you.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to establish this as a principle, because if that's an operating principle, I can have any number of collaborations in the world, and any collaborator would totally trust me because I'm granting them ownership of the original idea.
It's all very exciting.
Yeah.
It's a new frontier, a free zone
it's
frontier.
It's crucial to my development of the free zone.
Yeah. I think so. That's what I'm excited about, is to see this, because as I'm finding my place in the free zone, that I see where I have the best contributions,
Yeah.
So. Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
it's fun to see it evolve.
Yeah, well, it'll be great then having you.
I'll be there.
In collaboration on Thursday, because I think this will be a great discussion.
I can't wait. All right, I enjoy it. I will talk to you on Thursday.
Yeah. Thanks, Dean.
Thanks,
bye.
Man. Bye.